just gets infinitely tiled like this. And then we have, that's a terrible drawing, but this is the outer event horizon, and that's the inner event horizon for a Reisner-Nordström black hole. Okay. So now you can imagine, well, what would happen? Well, we need some more horizons, because in addition to black hole event horizons, if this is a Reisner-Nordström de Sitter black hole, then you can guess there's probably also a cosmological horizon, so there's a de Sitter-like horizon. So then we take this diagram, and now this is not a null infinity anymore. This is like another event horizon. So we get this, and then we can keep going, and eventually you'll just keep tiling this forever in this direction and forever in this direction. So oddly enough, the Reisner-Nordström de Sitter black hole, like the global space-time, would have an infinite number of regions that are causally disconnected. So you've got these regions that correspond to falling through the outer and inner black hole event horizon, just alternating forever and ever and ever. Or maybe you could come here and then fall out. You could make your way over to this de Sitter region, but there's another de Sitter region over here, and another one over here, and another one over here. And so it's this non-compact geometry both in space and time. Pretty bizarre, the global geometry if you put a charged black hole in a de Sitter space. Okay, so did you guys see the optional part? Did anyone get to that where you learned how to make this tiling? No. Okay. It's a bit tangential for what we're doing today, but if anyone's interested, I'm happy to spend a couple minutes after the class and we can go over that. Yeah. Okay. But you get the point, I hope, that conformal diagrams are just a convenient way of representing the global causal structure of a space-time in a way that you can visualize. So the most important take-home points are the existence of event horizons. So the fact that null rays that go in here can not come back, and the different nature of conformal infinity. So for example, the causal structure of this de Sitter space is quite different than, for example, the causal structure of a Robertson-Walker universe. Here, I just have to wait long enough, and I can see absolutely everything in the universe. So here, it's partial, but if I wait long enough, I can see everything. But in a de Sitter universe, that's not true. I can wait an infinite amount of time, but I'm only going to see some fixed finite piece of the space-time, okay? And that's the big difference between time-like spatial infinity here and having a null future infinity, and here, time-like spatial infinity with a space-like null infinity. So that's basically what I wanted you to take home. So Robertson-Walker is very different than de Sitter. Schwarzschild black hole is reminiscent of de Sitter in a sense, because if I'm an observer that falls into a black hole, unfortunately, I can't see all the interesting stuff that might happen out here, right? So again, it's the space-like nature of the singularity, the fact that I hit it and it's space-like, and different observers hit it in different places and therefore would see different things. That's just a feature of the causal structure of a black hole space-time. So these diagrams are useful just to visualize which parts of space are causally connected to others, effectively. All right, so then let's go back to what we were talking about at the end of class yesterday, which was the homogeneous universe. Okay, so we saw that, or reviewed that, the homogeneous universe is well described by the Robertson-Walker metric. We introduced a convenient time variable, the conformal time. Okay, which which was nice because null rays traveled on 45 degree lines. So as a warm up, why don't we return to this? And we brought up at some point in class yesterday this simple calculation, for example, of how old the universe is. So why don't we just do that to warm up? So first of all, we probably want to know how the scale factor behaves. So we had an equation yesterday for h. So we had this equation for h over h naught squared in terms of these omegas, which were the energy density fraction in different species. Okay. So we could calculate the age of the universe given what we know about these fractions today by simply calculating t as an integral from t equals 0 to today dt. Okay, that's just formal, right? That's not saying anything. It's a little bit more convenient if we rewrite this as an integral over a. Because now I can re-express this as h through h, right? So this is just dA over ah, and we're going to integrate this from a equals 0. That's basically where the singularity is, right? If this is a true Robertson-Walker universe, to today. And in our conventions, today is just where the scale factor equals 1. So we can do this in general. Unfortunately, I can't write for you an analytic expression of what this is, for example, in our universe, in a lambda CVM universe. But for most of the history of our universe, it was matter dominated. So we can make a pretty good approximation by assuming that we just have a matter dominated universe. So in a matter dominated universe, we can solve for this. So h is h naught. A matter dominated universe, a cold dark matter, is pressureless. So that means W is 0. Because remember, W was the thing that related density to pressure. So that means that this is just h naught times a to the minus 3 halves. Okay, so we can shove that in here. This is now just going to be an integral from a equals 0 to 1 dA. And then I'm going to get an 1 over a to the minus 1/2 or square root a. So that means, and I'm also going to get an h naught that I'll have to pull out. So that means that the age of the universe in a matter-dominated universe is just h naught inverse. And then here, when I perform the integral, I'll get an a to the 3/2. So it's going to be 2/3 h naught inverse. Okay. So you can see roughly the age of the universe is the inverse of h naught. And that is roughly, you know, some number times 10 billion years. And you could be more precise. You can stick in what we know for all these components and derive the real age of the universe. And now we know that to be, you know, something like 13.7. And there's more significant digits on this years because we know all of these components fairly precisely now. Okay. So that's the age of the universe. That's just a warm up. We had one thing left to do from last time on the homogeneous universe, which was to define how we measure distances. Okay. So a convenient measure of distances in the homogeneous universe is something called the angular diameter distance. I'll start with a new board because I want to draw a picture. So let's say I'm sitting here at eta naught at some time. And I'm looking back into the past. This is just some spatial section. Okay. And there's some object which is, we'll say, of some length L, okay, some physical length L. And this object, from each side of it, is sending out some null rays which reach me here at eta naught. So here, this time, we'll call it some eta emits. This is the time at which this light was sent out. And let's say the object is at some distance, some co-moving distance r emit. Okay. Then these null rays are very simply described, because we're working in terms of conformal time. So it's just eta is eta emit plus r emit. Okay. Or we can rewrite this and say that today eta emit is eta naught minus r emit. So this is a physical distance. So if we look at that metric, we know that the physical distance is related to a co-moving distance through a factor of a. And this total length, if it subtends some angle theta, right, in that metric, null rays don't change their angle. So nothing in that metric depends on theta. So an null ray that is emitted at some angle is just received at that same angle. So we can express L, this physical length, as the scale factor at the time these photons were emitted, times the co-moving distance r times delta theta. Okay, that's just the angular scale subtended by this object, and thus the angular scale I would see when I receive these photons. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry about that. So these are just for emit. So any subscript you see is either emit or not. That's the only one that's not. Okay, so I have this relation here, which I can now solve for delta theta. Okay. So delta theta is just going to be L. And then I have this relation for null rays. The scale factor at eta naught minus eta at which I emit over r. Okay. So if we were in a flat universe that was not expanding, then this would just be some fixed distance, right? So there would be a direct relation between the angular scale at which I see and the distance the object was away. But since we're in an expanding universe, this doesn't necessarily, is not just linear in time, right? So this scale factor has some dependence. So we can rewrite this also. It's useful sometimes to rewrite this in terms of a redshift. So remembering the definition of redshift, this is just 1 plus z over L, r emit. Okay, so that calculation we did up there is convenient because the conformal time elapsed between some early time and now is just equal for null rays to the proper distance that they, or the co-moving distance that they traveled, right? Null rays travel on lines of eta equals r plus constant. So in particular, r emit, an analogy to what we just had above, if instead we do this integral in terms of redshift, is just dz over h as a function of z. And converting what we had from a to z and nothing else, then we will find that this is just 2 over h naught. And then we've got 1 minus 1 over square root 1 plus z for matter domination. So for objects that are at a small redshift that are close to us, z is going to go to 0, So this distance is just 2 over h naught. Okay. For objects that are really far away, sorry, that's the opposite. For objects that are really far away, it's 2 over h naught. For objects that are really close, then r is going to 0. And if I expand this, it's going to 0 linearly in z. So that's kind of the usual definition of distance, right? Things get closer and linearly, the angular distance will change. Yeah. Okay, so where will we use this? So this, if we have an object which is a standard ruler, meaning we know L, and we measure delta theta, then we can get some idea of this comoving distance, right? And if we know that comoving distance, we can get some information about how the universe has expanded between us and that standard ruler. So we know L. We measure delta theta. And then we can infer properties of the expansion. Okay. So we can know what A of T is for our universe. So in the CMB, there is a standard ruler that we'll look at, which is the sound horizon. The sound horizon is basically just, given a certain amount of time, how far could sound waves have propagated in the early universe? And that's a physical quantity, so it's a standard ruler. It's the same everywhere. And that's something that shows up, as we will see. This is just a teaser. As these acoustic peaks. So you might have heard them called acoustic peaks in the CMB. And they are just that. So these are due to sound waves propagating in the early universe. And they have a fixed scale. So we're actually measuring an angular diameter distance by measuring the location of these peaks. And that's going to tell us something about the expansion of the universe. Okay. So that's a teaser, but we'll do that actually in great detail. Yes, questions? Yeah, this is the Brayon acoustic oscillations. That's right. OK, so that's about all I had to say about the homogeneous universe. And now we're going to talk about the perturbed universe. So I told you yesterday that for most of the history of the universe, we can describe space-time by this metric. And so these quantities here are much less than 1. And this is it. So basically, I told you that we just need to solve Einstein's equations, assuming this metric, and some matter, which we're going to take to be perfect fluids. But in fact, when I wrote this down, implicitly, I was making a choice. So the choice I was making was a certain set of coordinates. So I've picked some coordinates, t and x. And in this specific set of coordinates, I get some small perturbations that are a function of t and x. But I didn't have to make that choice. I could have made other choices. So as I said yesterday, my relativist friends go crazy when you start making coordinate choices and you don't calculate invariance. And these things are definitely not invariants. So let's step back for a minute and let's try and be a little bit more careful and ask more generally, what does the perturbed universe look like if I can choose any coordinates that I want? So more generally, we're going to have some metric, which is going to be some background piece. Okay, so this is like the Robertson Walker universe, plus some small perturbations, which we'll call delta G mu nu. And again, I'm choosing some specific set of coordinates, but now I'm keeping it a little bit more general because I'm not telling you what the functions are, where they appear, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So what is G mu nu? So the metric G mu nu is by construction symmetric. And in four dimensions, there's going to be 10 components. So did you go through the counting of all these things in the Bianchi identities in your GR classes and whatnot? Yeah, OK, fantastic. So in four dimensions, this is a symmetric matrix, so it has 10 components. But there's the Bianchi identities. There's four of them. So really, there's only six independent components. Okay? So these you can think of as choices of coordinates, effectively. Okay, so we'll see in detail how that works. Okay? So we can go back. Really, there are six, but we start with 10. And these 10 different components of the metric fluctuations, we can classify them according to their transformation properties. So they can be scalars, vectors, or tensors. So if we're looking at small perturbations around Robertson Walker, then T is somewhat distinguished. Okay, we can mix T and the spatial components. But the spatial components themselves, I'm free to perform rotations and translations and all sorts of stuff. So when I say scalars, vectors, and tensors, I mean scalars, vectors, and tensors under spatial rotations. So I can implement a spatial rotation by taking my my coordinates, we'll call them x mu prime, and I can turn those into another set of coordinates via this. Okay, so that's going to implement a rotation if I define this matrix here as just 1, 0, 0, so it does nothing to time. But it's going to take my my spatial indices and perform a rotation where you'll recall that the rotation matrix has the property that R transpose R is the identity. So I can take this, apply it to a set of coordinates, and I'll get a new set of coordinates, right? This is just a rotated version of my original one. So now I can transform the metric, right? So the metric is a tensor. So in order to transform the metric, I need to apply two of these matrices. Sorry. Okay, so this will accomplish a rotation of the metric. And so living in here, if this is my perturbations, then living in here, I'm going to have pieces of the metric which are going to transform differently under these rotations. So in particular, let's look at this. So there's some spatial component, right? So I can imagine trying to perform a coordinate transformation on this matrix, and it's not going to do anything to the time piece, right? So that's just going to fully remain. All that's going to happen is that this is just going to be a function of the new coordinates, whatever the rotated coordinates are. And that's a scalar. So scalars just transform their argument. So A prime as a function of X prime is just equal to A as a function of X, right? All I've done is change the coordinates, the argument. Vectors, of course, will transform under the rotations. So they're going to get rotated by that rotation, the spatial rotation matrix. And tensors, well, I'm just going to pick out the spatial parts of the metric. So these are going to transform under two actions of the rotation matrix. Okay. So generally, I'm going to have components of my perturbations that will transform like scalars, vectors, and tensors. So hidden in here are different things. So for example, you know, I have some vector, right? But that vector, generally, we know you can rewrite as the sum of a scalar piece and a true vector degree of freedom. So what is the scalar piece? This is just like in ENM, when we define gauge potentials. So I can define a scalar component by requiring that the curl of this piece is zero. So I can take my vector and I can decompose it as the sum of a curlless field and a divergenceless field. So the curlless field just has, we can define this curlless field as just negative grad of a scalar. Well, V is divergenceless. And similarly, we can decompose tensors into scalar, vector, and tensor degrees of freedom. And so doing this, performing this split, explicitly acting these transformations on the metric, what one finds is that in total, there's going to be four scalar degrees of freedom hidden in that delta G mu nu. There's going to be four vector degrees of freedom and two true tensor degrees of freedom. So the tensors are just gravitational waves. Did you guys do the derivation for getting the transverse traceless part of the metric out for gravitational waves at any point? Yeah? Okay. So that's just that. This is nothing more than that calculation. So there you probably projected out the tensor part of the metric and you identified those as gravitational waves. That's the tensor part. The scalar part is going to be interesting because the scalar part is what's going to source fluctuations in matter. And the vector part isn't going to be interesting because this is going to decay in an expanding universe. Okay. So these are the 10 components. So those are the 10 components that we have in an arbitrary symmetric matrix in four dimensions. But of course, there are constraints. So we get to make some choices about which set of these fluctuations is not zero and which ones are. And because we're going to be most interested in stuff that sources fluctuations, so stuff that sources fluctuations in matter and radiation, because that's what gives rise to the anisotropies in the CMB and large-scale structure and all that, we're going to be most interested in the scalar parts. Okay, so we can write down just the scalar parts of the most general metric that we can write down. And for the moment, I'm going to work in terms of t and not eta, but we'll quickly go back to t. Okay, so here's the scalar part. That's the same, the true scalar part as the one we had over here. So when I implement these rotations, that's the thing that's just going to change the argument. We've got this piece, which is the scalar part of a vector degree of freedom. So this is like the curlless part. So I've got a grad b. That's this piece. And then this piece is the scalar part of the tensor perturbations. Okay. So this is when I project out the scalar part of the tensors and throw away the gravitational waves. So again, these different functions, so in general I have four functions here. So I've got A, B, C, and E. Maybe I should have called that one D just for consistency, but whatever. Okay, we're skipping D. Don't like D. So these four functions are not in general independent. Okay, so there is, quote, gauge freedom. And by gauge, I just mean the choice of coordinates. Okay, so gauge here is just the choice of coordinates. Yes?
I'm so sorry. I'm just trying to reconcile what you mean by scalar vector part. So
yeah, so if I took these rotation matrices and I acted on these different parts of the metric,
yes.
So if I just acted those rotation matrices on the metric, I would find that all that happens is these functions, A, B, C, and E, they just change coordinates, right? So I don't... Yeah, so they're scalars in that sense. They're scalars under spatial rotations. Yeah, so the, exactly, so the scalar part of the tensor, you just get back the same scalar part, but it would just be a function of the new coordinates. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Does the decomposition of your vectors have any conditions?
Just those, the fact that I've defined this function b, it had better be, So that's the condition, just that it's split into a divergenceless and a curlless piece. And you can generally always do that. Okay. You can take any vector and split it into two pieces. Okay. So we've got these scalar pieces. And in different sets of coordinates, the universe is just going to look different. Okay. I mean, that's manifest. So let's think about how it might look different. Let's say I had a pure Robertson-Walker universe. So I have some slicing where the density is constant on some time slices. So the vertical axis here would be like time. And these are just density equals constant hypersurfaces. And now I just arbitrarily, because I'm allowed to, define a new set of coordinates. So in my new set of coordinates, the slices of constant time look like this. So in this set of coordinates, the density is certainly not constant, right? So the density here is higher than it is, say, here, which is higher than it is here and there, and so on. So I can implement this coordinate transformation just at each point in space. I have some transformation. So I'm gonna shift by delta t, which is the function of x and t in these background coordinates. So then I could define a new time variable t tilde, and that's just going to be t plus delta t and x. And if I had some quantity, say like the density, so in the original coordinates, it was just rho as a function of t, which is constant. But now this is going to go to, I have t tilde minus delta t. And if this is small, so we can just Taylor expand this if it's small, then this is going to be rho as now a function of t tilde minus d rho dt times delta t. And this looks like some fluctuation, right? So just by changing coordinates in this new set of coordinates, rho now looks like it fluctuates in space. Okay. But all I've done is change coordinates. So how do we decide if this is a physical thing or if it's not a physical thing? I mean, everyone is going to see something different. So the answer is, it doesn't matter, because when we stick this into Einstein's equations and we make everything consistent, then we're just going to get some answer in this particular gauge, right? So as long as we make a choice and we make a consistent choice, at the end of the day, if we're calculating physical quantities, then it shouldn't matter. I can't make black holes, for example, by just changing coordinates. Or I can't make events happen with just by changing coordinates, right? There are physical things that we can calculate. Okay, so things change. So it does kind of matter what coordinates you use, but if we're careful, it shouldn't matter. So now let's talk about how to be careful. Okay, so to implement a general coordinate transformation, we already wrote it down, but we'll write it down again. So the things that we'll be interested in are the metric and the energy momentum tensor, right? Those are the things that go into Einstein's equations. Those are the things that we're going to evolve. So the metric can be transformed simply by taking partial derivatives of the new coordinates as a function of the old ones. So if I know, for example, what that function is, delta t and x, I can implement this coordinate transformation and tell you what the metric is in this new set of coordinates. And similarly, for the energy momentum tensor, that's just another tensor, so it transforms in exactly the same way. This is going to be, again, the same deal. Okay? So we can always change coordinates just by implementing this as long as I know what the new coordinates are as a function of the old. Okay? And so if these are really small changes in coordinates, then I can just consider them as linear shifts of the coordinates at different positions, just like I did over there. So a little bit more generally, we can define t tilde as t plus some function, we'll call it c0, which can be a function of t and x. And we can take the spatial coordinates and we can shift them by another function, okay, which we can always express as just the gradient of some function of t and x. So if I'm only interested in scalars, then I'm only interested in screwing things up in a scalar way. So I can always express this coordinate transformation as a gradient. Okay. So now let's just do this. So for example, we could see how the 0,0 component of a metric behaves. So we'll look at that metric there. So G0,0, okay, which is just as we have it up there, -1 + 2a, is going to be equal to the metric in some other set of coordinates. Okay, so we need to sum over all of these guys here. So doing that, we'll have G tilde 0,0 D T tilde DT squared. And then we're going to have the mixed component, the I XI T component, right? So there we're going to have plus G 0 I D tilde T dt dx tilde I dt. And then we're going to have the spatial part. So we'll have g ij tilde dx tilde I dt dx tilde j dt. So we're doing this in perturbation theory. So all of these functions up there, A, B, C, and E, are assumed to be small. And we're also assuming that this shift is sort of an infinitesimal shift in the coordinates. So that means that xi, 0, and di xi are also much less than 1. So now let's think about these different pieces. So here for the 0i piece of the metric, let me just pull this up, start writing. So g tilde 0 I is just 2a b tilde, sorry, di b tilde. So this is a small thing, right? This is a first order quantity. And I have over there, for example, so there's dt tilde dt. That's going to be equal to 1 plus C0 ddt, right? That's just literally performing that. And then we're going to have dx tilde dt. And there, the first piece is 0, but I can generally have a mixed space-time derivative. So that's going to be delta ij ddt ddx j on xi. So this is a first order piece. So that means that this guy here will be a first order piece times a zero order piece times a first order piece, so that this is really a second order thing. Okay. So it's second order in a small quantity, therefore I can neglect it. So I don't have to worry about that guy. And similarly, here, I've got dxi dt, that's a first order piece, that's a first order piece, and therefore this is going to be another second order thing, and therefore I can neglect it, as long as all these things are small quantities. So that's gone. Okay, nice. So all we really have to worry about is that other piece there. So g00 tilde is just negative 1 plus 2a tilde in this new set of coordinates. So we'll write that out. So what we're left with is that negative 1 plus 2a is equal to negative 1 plus 2a tilde. And then I have dt d tilde squared. That's this guy. So that's 1 plus d c0 dt squared. And since I'm only interested in first order things, then I can expand this and throw away the dt ddt term, okay, and just keep this guy. So expanding this out and just keeping the first order stuff, we get negative 1 minus 2a tilde. And then we'll also pick up from this cross term negative 2 d c0 dt. Okay. So this, if now we get rid of the minus signs and we cancel off the 1, tells us how to get a tilde from a. So a in this new set of coordinates is just going to be given by a, and I think I was sloppy somewhere. No, I'm good. A minus ddt c0. And we'll probably find it convenient to work in terms of conformal time. So we can turn this ddt into a dd eta by adding a 1 over a. Because dt d eta is equal to a. OK. So under a small change of coordinates, we know how a transforms. And similarly, we can go through these other metric functions that appear. We've got b, c, and e. We can figure out how they transform. So that I will leave as an exercise. But the method is the same. So here we're going to have c tilde being c minus dA d eta 1 over a times c0. We'll have b tilde as b minus c0 over a plus d c d eta. And we'll have e tilde as e plus c. So this is how the metric transforms under shifts of coordinates. So now if I give you the metric in one set of coordinates, you can tell me what it is in others. Furthermore, we've got two independent functions here, right? So we have c0, which don't know what's up with my random shifts in notation. We have xi0 and xi, which I can pick arbitrarily. This is just my choice. It's a coordinate transformation. I can do whatever I want. So that means that I can set any two of these metric functions to 0 by an appropriate choice of xi0 and xi. So that's my gauge freedom in the scalar sector. I always have the freedom by picking these functions to be what they should be. I always have the freedom in order to set any two of these to zero. So what do people use? We'll start here. So this is a particular choice of gauge, this description. So this is called the conformal Newtonian gauge. Okay, here's an admission. Half of the textbooks in the world and half of the papers in the world call one of these phi and the other psi. And the other half of the textbooks in the world and the papers in the world call one of these phi and one of these, so it's they use the same letters, but they're opposite. I will try my best to be consistent, but please be forgiving. So in my notation, it should be psi multiplying the dt part and phi multiplying the spatial part. Okay, aside from that hitch, how do we get there? Well, we need to pick these functions such that E and B are zero, and then we identify A as psi and what I called C as phi. So in this particular gauge, in order to get B and E zero, I needed to pick basically C is negative E, and Xi zero and Xi, the eta derivative, act to cancel off B. And this is just one choice among many choices that we can make. So just a quick tour through the zoo of gauges, which will probably bring us to the end of today. So another gauge is the synchronous gauge. And traditionally, this is one of the first ones that was used to calculate in cosmological perturbation theory. So in the synchronous gauge, we have A and B chosen to be zero. And so the metric looks like A squared negative d eta squared. And then we have the plus 1 plus 2c plus di dj e minus. So it's called synchronous because each of the constant positions in this case just is, you know, you're basically measuring proper time along different trajectories. So if I sit at a constant position x, then my time variable is just proper time. So that's the synchronous gauge. The synchronous gauge has a rather unfortunate problem in that it's not unique. So in fact, there's a family of synchronous gauges. So the way we see that is by saying, well, we could have Xi naught be a function of x only, but not of eta. Okay. So we'll leave this just as a function of space. And so if that's true, and we define Xi as C naught, which is again just a function of x, times the integral d eta over a plus c1, which is just a function of x, and I stick these definitions into b and a there, you'll find that A, from this definition, always equals A tilde, right? So I could have picked any function of x for C naught. And from this condition, if we shove that in there, we'll find that B always equals B tilde. So any functions that I choose that satisfy these requirements will give me the same metric. Okay. So that's the synchronous gauge. And continuing our tour through the zoo, actually, I'll leave that. There's the spatially flat gauge. So if I set C and E equal to 0, then the metric is going to look like A squared of eta. I've got my 1 plus 2A dt squared. But the spatial sections now you can see are just flat. So they're just the Cartesian plane. Hence the creative name, spatially flat. Okay, this gauge is convenient for calculating fluctuations in inflation, we'll find. So that's one. There's just one more I'd like to discuss. And that's the uniform density gauge. So here, if we set E to 0, and we're going to call C something called a Xi, then the metric is going to look something like this. So we'll have our A squared, and then we'll have the 1 plus 2A d eta squared. One plus two zeta dx squared. You'll recognize this from your homework problem 3 as the gauge that Latham wanted you to solve for the inflationary perturbations in. So why is it the uniform density gauge? So here I've made only one choice, which is that E is 0, and I've just renamed C as this thing, so you could recognize it as something you'd seen before. But additionally, we can choose that in this gauge, the density is equal to 0. The density fluctuations is equal to 0. So if I had some spacetime, which in some set of coordinates had fluctuations in the density, I'm just going to define these rho equals constant surfaces as specifying my time variable. So I'll just choose my shift in time at each point in space to cancel off whatever shift in density there is. And I can always do that. OK, so that's the tour through the gauges. And just real quick before you leave, if you don't want to do this, then you can always work in variables that don't depend on the gauge. So in particular, I can define two functions, which are called the Bardeen potentials, and are defined as follows. which I leave it for you an exercise to check, this particular combination of these functions, A, B, C, and E, don't depend on my choice of xi-naught and xi. So this combination is chosen in just the right way so that, that all of that dependence just cancels out. So these are gauge invariant variables. Meaning that they're independent of my choice of coordinates. So why don't we end it here, and then I will pick up next time by solving Einstein's equations for this metric, and we'll talk more about how the energy momentum tensor transforms for a perfect fluid. So that's where we're going. Any questions on what you've seen today? Yeah.
What do you use those for?
So there's two approaches. I can always choose a gauge and calculate, and there's nothing wrong with that. Or I can work in terms of these gauge invariant variables and calculate. There's nothing wrong with that. But I always need to make sure that I'm only introducing 2 degrees of freedom, because I know in reality there's only 2 true degrees of freedom. So there's 2 ways of doing that. Either I work in terms of the gauge invariant variables, where explicitly I have the right linear combination so that there's only 2 independent degrees of freedom. Or I pick a gauge where things are particularly convenient for calculations, where I've already fixed all of the conditions that I can have, and therefore I only have 2 real degrees of freedom. And people use both approaches. It really just kind of depends on which one makes the calculations easier. That's the only reason to choose. Any other questions? Okay. If not, then I will see you tomorrow.